It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running, there is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying. It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running, there is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying.
It's Going Down is a digital community center from anarchist, anti-fascist, autonomous, anti-capitalist, and anti-colonial movements. Our mission is to provide an autonomous and resilient platform to publicize and promote revolutionary theory and action.
Go to itsgoingdown.org for daily updates. Check out our online store for ways to donate and rate and follow us on iTunes if you like this podcast. In the age of Trump, talk of globalism and the devastating impact of free trade deals has been recuperated by the far right of the Republican Party, who have used such talk as a smokescreen for ramming through a set of pro-billionaire policies all of their own. But in the 1990s, it was anarchists and autonomous anti-capitalists that were seen to be at the forefront of attacking corporate globalization and the capitalist system, as they disrupted and shut down free trade meetings in the U.S. and movements like the Zapatistas launched uprisings in Mexico and beyond. In this episode of the IGDcast, which is the second in a series where we look at anarchist organizing in the 1990s, we caught up with Dave, formerly a member of the Green Mountain Anarchist Collective, which was part of the larger federation of anarchist collectives known as NEFAC. Throughout this discussion, we talk about how Dave got involved in anarchist organizing while living in rural Vermont, but moreover about what the anarchist movement was involved in during the mid to late 1990s. Throughout our discussion, Dave talks about how the anti-globalization movement grew both in size, scope, and intensity, as we touch on the importance of the Seattle anti-WTO mobilization and riots in November of 1999, and why the success of the blockades was an important victory for the anarchist movement. We also spend the bulk of our time focusing on the Black Bloc, as Dave lays out its application and its historical importance. Lastly, Dave talks about his own relationship with people in the labor movement, some of whom respected and applauded the risks being taken in the streets by anarchist militants. Dave pulls from his own experiences while as a member of the Green Mountain Anarchist Collective, which fought in solidarity with workers on strike, and how his group was able to build solid relationships with people who did not consider themselves revolutionaries. The anti-globalization struggle in the late 1990s and early 2000s is an important period to analyze and discuss, as we continue to live in a world drastically impacted by neoliberalism and the policies that it helped globalize. Thanks for listening. Let's get into it. Okay, thank you for tuning into the It's Going Down podcast. We're joined here today with Dave. Dave is a former member of the Green Mountain Anarchist Collective and also the Northeastern Federation of Anarcho-Communists, or NEFAC. We're going to be doing a series of interviews with people about the 90s and about the anti-globalization movement, about just different struggles that happened in the 90s and the early 2000s, just picking people's brains. Dave is the author of a brand new book that's a collection of articles and essays from the Green Mountain Anarchist Collective. But Dave, do you just want to get started and introduce yourself real quick?
Sure. Pleasure to be with you here today. This is Dave Van Dusen calling from Cabot, Vermont. So any questions you have, by all means, it's a pleasure to be on the line with you today.
Sure. And just to get started, how did you become radicalized? And from there, how did you get involved in the anarchist movement?
Well, I don't have a moment, I would say, when my politics changed. My parents, David Van Dusen and Cheryl Partridge, they were both at Woodstock in 69. And the household I grew up in had certain values, shall we say, certain countercultural values. When my father would go outside with me to throw a baseball back and forth or kick a soccer ball back and forth, we'd stop occasionally and he would talk to me about socialism and why it is absurd that the people themselves do not control and own the means of production, essentially. And he would give me these talks as a kid. And also talk about the Black Panther Party, for that matter. And I don't know that I 100% understood them as a child, what he was saying, but he imparted certain values. And in that household, just growing up, knowing that people like Muhammad Ali were true heroes, were part of what went into who I am today and who I was yesterday. So I was involved with politics throughout my younger life, I should say, as well. In high school, like a lot of folks, I was in a band, where a punk band, and part of that kind of scene back in the day, and always had a notion of anarchism and supported the ideas, but not in a very nuanced way back then, I would say. Then it was more of what Bakunin would describe as an instinct to rebel, and it made sense. And it was throughout going from being a teenager into my 20s where I started actually learning what the different forms of anarchism mean, and beyond just the knee-jerk reaction against authority. And those remain compelling to me. So there wasn't a single moment. It's part of the product of a life, I guess I would say.
Right. So you were what some people would describe as a red diaper baby or a red and black diaper baby?
Yeah, I mean, in a sense, I don't know that. Well, my parents, neither of my parents would describe themselves as anarchists by any stretch. But my father was a union member. He was a member of the Public Employees Federation in New York. And later in his career, he was a union officer. And both my mother and my father held alternative values and despised the acute capitalism of, let's say, Reagan, or earlier than that, Nixon, for that matter. And so just certain values, socialist values in a broad sense, were part of my life from the start.
From that point, you said you were in a punk band and, you know, you slowly kind of discovered anarchism. Did the Green Mountain Anarchist Collective form first, or did you first join NEFAC? You know, how did you become just somebody that was reading to somebody that was actively involved in the movement?
Well, the Green Mountain Anarchist Collective formed, if I remember right, in 2000, late 2000, just after Seattle. Prior to that, come 96, 97, in southern Vermont, the same general area where the Green Mountain Anarchist Collective formed 3 years later, I founded a group called the Liberation Movement. That organization was probably my first attempt to form a, not just hold political beliefs as an individual or as part of a counterculture, but as an organization. And that group was anarchist in bent, I should say. But we didn't have a real focus of activity or strategic vision, I would say. We did support work around Mumia Abdul-Jamal. We went around and collected petition signatures, etc., for that cause. We also were marginally involved with local volunteerism at a center for poor people in Brattleboro, Vermont. But it being new to trying to see what the possibilities and limitations are of political organizing in a new kind of organization, I would say that was not a high point of effectiveness. But when we founded the Green Mountain Anarchist Collective in 2000, our immediate goal was to, on the heels of Seattle, was to lend material support and strategic insight into Black Bloc actions. And that was the initial focus there. So at least we had a firm focus. Then we joined NEFAC later in 2002. And after we did that, and the collective kind of was reborn, it moved from its center of gravity from southern Vermont to northern Vermont. We began to much more get involved with community organizing and trying to come up with means to actually achieve the libertarian socialist society that we envisioned. So that's obviously a longer conversation, but that was much more involved and nuanced than my previous political activity.
Right, and we're going to kind of
you know, pick up some of these points and kind of go off with them. But, you know, just to get started, let's just describe what NEFAC was, you know, in the as some people remember, we have interviewed people talking about the 1980s and 1990s, the Group Love and Rage, which was an anarchist federation that kind of came and went. And then NEFAC was another attempt at an anarchist federation of different collectives in Canada, in the United States. But if can you just describe it, you know, what it is, what its politics were, and also what the fuck is an anarcho-communist for those listening?
Initially, I'll say this. Initially, when the Green Mountain Anarchists formed in 2000, we reached out to NEFAC, which was just forming at the time as well. And myself and Xavier Mousseau, who was a founding member of the collective as well, we initially told them that we were interested in joining, but we were not thrilled that they chose the name with the word communist in it. We felt that there was no with a cost-benefit analysis, we didn't think that that was a wise move, right? So how many people actually know in the United States what anarcho-communism is versus how many people would hear the word communism and immediately think Russia, Stalin, that kind of thing? And NEFAC, you know, they were probably like, who the fuck are these guys calling from Vermont, and why are we going to change their name for them, right? So initially we did not join, although we had some very good conversation back and forth about black bloc tactics. That said, what is anarcho-communism? It is a worker-centric, I would say, a worker-centric class analysis-based approach to achieving both a libertarian and socialist society. Just so you know, I don't put a hell of a lot of credence into the different dogmas within the anarchist movement. I mean, you have the anarcho-syndicalists, which are strictly union-based. They're going to achieve our goals through a democratic union-based structure. Anarcho-communism, you know, a class-based communal starting point to achieve your goals, or the other different forms. I would describe myself more accurately as a libertarian socialist, which I think is a good description of what my views are. But NEFAC itself was the dynamic organization, at least in the Northeast, but really a model for the rest of the country in the early 2000s for a period of years. They were instrumental in organizing some of the more effective black bloc actions, be it in D.C. or in Boston during that period of time. They were growing. When we joined them in 2002, they were a growing organization. I don't remember exactly, but we could say maybe 15 collectives around the Northeast region. They had a number of collectives in Quebec, which appealed to us because in Vermont, Quebec is our neighbor to the north. And often, for a lot of us, the closest big city is Montreal. And there's also cultural similarities, in a sense, and historical similarities between Vermont and Quebec. So to have an opportunity to work more collaboratively with folks just across the northern border very much appealed to us. And the fact that they were the leading force in the regional eastern black bloc organizing black bloc actions also appealed to us, as that was our initial focus as a collective. So all of those things combined, it made sense for us to become a member.
Right.
Ironically, shortly after we joined, maybe a year into it, it's hard to recall, at a conference, an NEFAC conference in Baltimore, the organization voted to take focus away off of building black bloc actions and to put it squarely on labor and community organizing. We agreed that that was a shift we should make, but we as a collective did not believe that one was mutually exclusive to the other. So we argued against that shift in strategic focus, but were outvoted. And respecting the democratic process, we respected the decision of the organization, which we voluntarily joined.
Right. And I would just add real quick, I think a lot of young people or people kind of new to anarchism see the word anarcho-communism. They think, oh, it's like mixing the best of, you know, Marxist-Leninism and the best of anarchism. That's really not what it is. You know, the word communism actually predates Marx. It predates Marxism. And it was just a way for anarchists to make clear that the future vision of society that they wanted was something that did not involve money. It did not involve markets. Instead, it involved, you know, a stateless society, but also a society in which the means of existence were held in common, and that there was not a state that either controlled the economy, or there were not private firms or capitalist businesses that controlled production. Instead, the production and human labor went to human needs. You know, the famous, you know, slogan, for each according to their own, for each according to ability. I mean, that be put into practice. And, you know, the term anarcho-communism was supposed to denote that. It had nothing to do with mixing Marxism, or especially Marxist-Leninism, with anarchism.
Well said. Well said. And I know that, you know that, the listeners may know that, but
right.
your average blue-collar American may not know that. And
right.
So,
yeah.
Not to harp on it, but our initial question was, well, why would you use a word? It's a word. That's what it is. That may alienate folks before they hear your message. One of the first rules of organizing in my later life, I've spent years now as a labor organizer and union rep. One of the first rules of organizing is don't make yourself the issue if you're the organizer, right?
Right.
Focus on the actual organizing issue. So it still boggles my mind a little why that was done in the beginning. But, you know, I respect it in the same kind of way when we were all young. When I was young, I had that instinct to rebel and give the big fuck you to a lot of the world around me, in a way, using a term that alienates a chunk of the society right off the bat is probably can be traced back to a knee-jerk rebellion of sorts against society at large. So what are you going to do?
Especially when you have a term like anarcho-communism, so it's like, you know, a term that a lot of people think means chaos, and then a lot of people think means, you know, red dictatorship. So it's like just all these terms. But, you know, just to kind of go back to NEFAC for a minute, I remember reading the literature at the time, and, you know, NEFAC was really centered around, at least in the, you know, late 90s, early 2000s, and you came in, you know, around the anti-globalization movement. Around anti-fascist organizing was a huge pillar at that time. And then also, you know, workplace and community organizing. But if you can just kind of take people back to when you kind of first kind of came into NEFAC, what was, you know, the movement like? What were people excited about? Like, we're going to talk about the anti-globalization movement and black box stuff in a minute, but just kind of the day-to-day things that people were organizing around, what was it like in the late 90s?
It was exciting. Somebody once said, couldn't tell you who, but it sticks in my mind. Back in the 80s, I remember somebody saying in the media or in a book or something along these lines that the 90s will make the 60s look like the 50s. And that was an interesting claim. It gave one something to look forward to. However, it came later, right? I mean, Seattle happens in 99. The signs were there even just before 96 that something was brewing. But it didn't explode until 99. So maybe that person was relatively right, but a little slower. It took a little more time. By the time Seattle happens, there was a notion in the air that real change, fundamental change, was coming, was on the brink. It was the first time, perhaps since 68, where people, lots of people, not just a small clique of people, were really starting to question the roots of our economic and political systems. Not just the symptoms of the wrongs of capitalism, but the actual questioning the roots of why is this system in place to begin with. In my personal experience, that's not something I saw before that. So once you have tens of millions of Americans or Canadians, North Americans, questioning these root questions or these root causes of the ills of society, many things become possible. And when you see in the streets of Seattle or in D.C. or wherever it may be, Teamsters marching side by side with IWW members and radical environmentalists, all of which saying the system is corrupt, the fix is in, many things become possible. Then, mind you, from 99 right up till September 11th, each of the demonstrations, the large ones, they were growing. They were growing and they were becoming more and more militant to the point where you could squint your eyes and see what a you could imagine, at least, what a revolution could look like. Things that previously seemed impossible began to be discussed as eventually probable. So it's in that environment that NEFAC starts to grow and take shape, and it's in that environment that the Green Mountain Anarchist Collective forms. Did we succeed? No, we didn't. But you never do succeed until you do, right? And September 11th put the brakes on the momentum that was
right.
That was taking shape.
Right. Yeah, and I just think I just want, you know, people to appreciate. I think a lot of people listening, you know, maybe, you know, we're not politically active in the 90s or you know, we're not even kind of aware of what all went down. But I mean, there was just so much that was going on. And, you know, there's going to be a series of podcasts that comes out on the It's Going Down podcast about kind of like organizing the 90s. But I mean, you know, there was anti-racist action, you know, Earth First was really active. You know, there were occupations of land like in Minneapolis, like the Minnehaha Free State. You know, there was a succession of events that led up to Seattle. I think a lot of people... it's kind of like when journalists talk about like punk rock, and it was like, you know, there was the Sex Pistols and then all of a sudden, you know, Green Day came out, but there was nothing in between. But obviously there was a bunch of stuff that happened that led up to Seattle, you know, that all went down that kind of added to this momentum. And there was a, you know, a lot of different like scenes and groups. I mean, obviously there was NEFAC, but in the Pacific Northwest, there was a growing, you know, ecological and green anarchist movement. That was happening. So there was, you know, there was a lot going on.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, if you want to look at a foreshadowing for Seattle, go back 3 years to 1996 in Chicago during the Democratic National Convention. There was a counter convention was organized by a lot of local activists, but there was center to that was Love and Rage. Mm-hmm. And there's a continuum there. Now, at those demonstrations, there was only thousands, you know, a couple thousand maybe in March. But all the elements were in place and the issues were being talked about that would explode in a popular consciousness 3 years later. But as a forerunner of, say, the independent media centers, which were a thing for a spell, there was a group in Chicago called Counter Media, which was one part alternative journalism, one part counterintelligence for the protesters. There were early black blocs that were organized there by Love and Rage. There were dozens and dozens of workshops held at an old warehouse type space at the counter convention, talking about and asking questions about the root causes of the ills of modern society. So you could see there many of the elements that we would see 3 years later, but multiply the numbers 3 years later by 10. And then you also think that in some ways, there's also a clear continuum between the organizing done by Love and Rage, and then later some of the organizing type stuff that was done by NEFAC or FRAC in the Midwest or the equivalent in the Pacific Northwest. And with Love and Rage, they left a stronger movement than they started with. They helped build anti-racist action collectives all around the country.
Uh-huh.
I believe come 99 or so, there was 60 ARA chapters around the nation. So that's huge. And also in Vermont, where most of my organizing throughout my life has been, Love and Rage, the local Love and Rage collective, the number 10 collective, essentially founded the Vermont Worker Center, which became the focal point for the entire labor movement of Vermont for a good part of a decade. So these were things we inherited from those who came just before us. There was members of NEFAC that were also members of Love and Rage. So I don't think that there's a clear line where you could say the era of Love and Rage started and NEFAC began, any more so than you could say any two points of time, they bleed into each other.
Right. Do you want to just talk a little bit about why Love and Rage disbanded? You're kind of painting a rosy picture. So I think some people would ask, you know, first of all, what was Love and Rage? And then also, why did it stop existing?
Well, I was never really very involved with Love and Rage. just to be clear, I had two points of contact with them. Is locally in Vermont, as part of the liberation movement, the precursor to the Green Mountain Anarchist Collective, we made contact with them. They were up north, we were in the south. And we had them come down to give a slideshow and presentation on the struggles going on in Chiapas, which some of their members were recently down there for. And so we knew some of them through that. And then my first interaction was in Chicago and observing them organizing the Black Bloc actions, which I took part in, and I was impressed with them. Beyond that, I had very little to do with the Love and Rage folks. My understanding is, which is not as good or as nuanced as what a lot of people could give you, but is there was a lot of ideological division. They didn't, in my mind, they didn't really ever have an ideological focus. They were loosely grouped together as quote-unquote revolutionary anarchists, which to this day I'm not exactly sure what the definition of that is. And a number of their leaders, whose names escapes me, quote-unquote leaders or high-profile members, started to be drawn towards Maoism and having internal debates about political ideology, more traditional versions of communism versus is anarchism. And they split apart, largely based on those internal divisions. But again, I don't claim to be an expert or have any special insight into that organization.
Right. Well, I'm wondering now if we can turn back towards Seattle. If you can just kind of take us back to that moment. I mean, why was it important? What all happened there that was so important for the anarchist movement and also for that point in time?
All right. Well, in 99, I was working as a farm hand in the Northeast Kingdom of Vermont. And throughout my day of living in the farmhouse, working the land, living in rural poverty, somehow or another a flyer for Seattle that was going to be happening in a few months' time made its way up to the farm. I probably should have stopped then and there and said, you know, if this has made it all the way up to the northeast corner of Vermont to the farm I work on, this must be something big. Something is brewing. But I didn't see it that way. I didn't see the signs on the wall. I didn't think it was going to be anything more than any other demonstration that we've seen in the last decade, 2,000 people, nothing that exciting. And when the farm season ended, November, I moved to Spain. And I was living in Seville, Spain, when Seattle happened. The day Seattle happened, that wasn't just news in the United States. That was front page newspaper articles in Spain, in Spanish articles, saying this is the most important thing in a social movement to happen in the United States in generations. So I remember going down to the corner store and getting a newspaper, and my Spanish is so shitty. It, you know, probably took me 3 hours to slowly fumble my way through the article to figure out what was going on. But in that neighborhood, in the poor working class neighborhood that I was living in Seville, the local socialist party organized meetings to talk about what was going on in the United States and going on in Seattle. So it was a huge buzz across the ocean. So this not only captured the imagination of the folks that live in North America, this was like a moment where people across the world were saying, holy shit, resistance is possible within the center of the capitalist world. Resistance within the center-right nation of the United States of America is possible. They shut it down. Holy shit, they shut it down. So the World Trade Organization, as you know, there's nothing democratic about it. They set trade policies, which in turn necessitate political policies and all of that across the world. They're not accountable to anybody other than the economic and political elites of the different nations. And for them, who have all the power and all the money, for them to be 100% shut down and have their talks fall apart by common citizens, union members, anarchists, students, environmentalists, t- to show that that is even possible to ourselves and also to the world is an amazing thing. How often does that happen? How often did that happen in the 60s? How often has that happened since? That is a moment that will be burned into the American consciousness for 200 years.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I wasn't there, but, you know, from our perspective, you know, it was, like you said, it was important because so many different types of people came together. And also, as you mentioned, for instance, like union members and stuff, like disobeyed orders from union bureaucrats, you know, continued to march, join the blockades. You know, there was a huge diversity of tactics, but also, you know, the revolt, you know, spread into the neighborhoods. You know, there was looting, people disobeyed the curfews. You know, it was more of a generalized kind of revolt against the state than just, you know, demonstrations per se. And also, you know, the state was ready for a bloodbath. I remember Clinton ordered, you know, massive amounts of body bags to be brought to Seattle in case they had to, you know, kill people. You know, there was a state of emergency that was called. And also just, you know, the infrastructure of the protest was amazing. You know, nowadays it would seem kind of, you know, that's exactly what you do. But at the time, you know, for instance, like, the indie media station, you know, was able to expose the brutality of the police, which seeped its way into the mainstream. Also the, you know, we're going to talk about this, you know, later, but, you know, the Black Bloc obviously became a household word.
Yeah. All of which are huge.
Yeah.
All of which are absolutely huge. And that's what I was driving out a bit when I was talking about Chicago 3 years earlier, because you do see those beginnings. You know, you see the Independent Media Center, which was key to Seattle and getting the word out and documenting what was happening. But you see that prefaced 3 years later by the counter media organization. But yes, the diversity of taxes, basically us having our shit together. Like, really having our shit together on a large scale. That in and of itself was amazing. And that doesn't happen overnight. That's a product of years of organizing and years of trial and error to get to the point where those kind of things are possible. And I would say furthermore, though, that part of the point you make about community involvement, then we see that again a year or two later, whatever it was, in Quebec on even a larger scale. I remember Cindy Milstein, who I haven't always seen eye to eye with about everything when it comes to Black Bloc actions in particular. She wrote an article about Quebec saying for the first time, anarchists were a minority of violent protesters as opposed to the minority of violent protesters.
Right.
And that's a huge change.
Right. You know, so let's just now turn towards the Black Bloc. I think a lot of people listening to this will be like, okay, there's this person in Vermont that's working in a farm. I think it's cold as shit. And there's Bernie Sanders is there. So, how are you just pumped about the Black Bloc and just kind of like take us back to that moment? You know, you've mentioned it several times.
Well, I mean, my first time marching with the Bloc, first time knowing what it was in 96 in Chicago. And I remember going on two different marches. And here's where I learned the value of masking up. First march I went on was an immigrants' rights march. I marched with the Bloc, but didn't mask up. And then as the situation escalated and we were pushing back somewhat against police directives, and talking some shit, you know, as these things go. I remember we were cornered off at one point with riot police all around us, and some of those cops that I had a little bit of a negative interaction with early on in the march, I remember them tapping each other on the shoulder and all pointing at me, and they were smiling, and the message was clear that when the order is given to charge, they're coming at me. And of course, I'm the one asshole without a mask on, you know, standing on top of a barricade with a flag, you know, so it's silly. And it was at that exact moment that I personally realized the value of the tactic and why you do that tactic. So the next time, the next day, it was, a march for political prisoners' rights. I masked up. And that was the first time I did such a thing. For the record, I marched with my cousin, who's now an IBEW union steward in New York, and that's where I learned the value. But In Vermont, right? Well, first of all, keep in mind, Vermont isn't just cows and maple syrup and hippies, right? I mean, there's certain stereotypes about it, and there's a kernel of truth to the stereotypes. But Vermont has a long and militant history of resistance to the status quo. Vermont was founded through a guerrilla struggle led by Ethan Allen and the Green Mountain Boys prior to the American Revolution. The Vermont fought a guerrilla war against the Royal New York Colony starting in 1770 going up to the Revolution. So those children here are raised on those stories. There are children's books about those fights of yeoman farmers against the powers that be. And nobody here, nobody would say anything other than they were great heroes. In fact, in our state house, sketched in granite in the capital of Montpelier, is an ode to guerrilla warfare. A quote from Ethan Allen is something along the lines of, rather than surrender, I will retreat into the hills with my hardy Green Mountain Boys and wage war against human nature at large. So you have to understand that there is a tradition of resistance here. And Vermont has never fully viewed itself as, how do I put it, as a homogenous section of the United States. There's always been an independent streak here. So people understand resistance, and they understand the need to fight back. But my experiences with Black Blocs prior to, or just prior to, forming the Green Mountain Anarchist Collective was in D.C. at A16, Chicago, as I said, numerous smaller demonstrations across the country. And at these, I saw us winning. I saw us carrying out the fight without suffering the kind of mass arrest that you see the symbolic peaceful nonviolent protesters often suffer. Personally speaking, I've never quite understood the desire or the willingness to sit down and voluntarily have yourself arrested. I believe there's a place and a time for that, and I believe there's situations where that is needed and effective. But speaking as just for myself, it feels wrong to me. I believe that resistance should be actual resistance and should not be symbolic.
Right.
And it should not concede defeat before it even starts. So that is something, or some things that drew me to those more militant Antifa and Black Bloc actions.
So when you bring up the term, winning exactly, I mean, can you just describe for people, what is that actually, what did that look like to you? I've heard this from people that were involved in the anti-globalization movement, this idea that things were escalating, that more people were getting involved, that people were winning. What did that actually look like?
Well, on the national scale, I think that people, just by questioning the root causes of the ills of society, was a huge step in the right direction. And on a large scale, labor unions representing millions of people having a willingness and a desire to form strategic partnerships with non-traditional allies from environmental groups on down is huge. And that makes the American status quo nervous at the very minimum. As long as we are divided, as long as we are in our silos, it is easy enough to keep us in our place. But united, of course, we have the numbers, we have the strength, we have the ability to radically change things. But my focus has largely always been inside the region of the Green Mountains in Vermont. So what does it look like here? Well, at the time, post-Seattle, what we started organizing here was, when I say we, I mean the movement, radical democratic farmer organizations. Farmers of dairy farmers. There was an attempt to form a radical, directly democratic labor union in the capital, which the idea was if we went in the capital, then we would spread out to the towns and small cities across Vermont. And these were concrete projects the Vermont State Employees Association, through their president at the time, Ed Stanek, sought to build a popular front of organizations all across Vermont and to have a common platform that we would work towards. And in the spirit of Seattle, he actually gave us, this is one of the largest, second largest labor union in the state, he gave the Green Mountain Anarchist Collective, agreed to, a full voting seat on the organizing committee. The AFL-CIO had a vote, and the Green Mountain Anarchist Collective had a vote.
Oh,
those
shit.
Kind of things weren't possible before Seattle. It was that desire to build a mass movement and a broad base from which we could challenge the status quo and seek to have real fundamental change.
You know, you brought up being a shop steward and, you know, obviously you have, you know, connections to organized labor. I'm just curious if you can take us back to that, you know, post-Seattle moment. You know, what were rank and file or union people saying about, you know, these crazy black bloc anarchists?
Well, at the time, I would venture to say that there wasn't a uniform response.
Sure.
But there was a notion that there are those who are for us, those who are with us, and those who are against us. And clearly, the WTM, the powers that be, those that support and work towards quote-unquote free trade treaties, were against us. They were sending jobs to other places, and those other places they sent the jobs to also had no or little rights for workers or environmental regulations or protections of any kind. And so everybody was getting hurt except for the big capitalists who were making money hand over fist. So if I had to generalize, I would say your average rank and file worker at the time, and even to this day, would say, holy shit, who are these kids standing up fighting? Good for them. They're with us on our issues. This is about jobs. This is about power. And they're on the right side of history. Where why should I have sympathy with those that are defending those very same policies and those very same treaties and those very same practices that mean I no longer can support my family on a good, dignified job where I have a union and I have protections. I think that the left, often the more liberal, soft left, has a very bad misconception of what your average worker gives a shit about one way or another. And they give way too much credence to what your average upper middle class person who's watching TV at, you know, at the on the 6 o'clock news is going to say. And those upper middle class folks, I don't give a shit if they're in the Democratic Party or who they think they are. They're never going to lift a finger and do anything real to make fundamental change in society because they're benefiting from the society. The reason they have the comforts they have is because of the class system that we exist under. So they may feel bad about how black and Latino people are treated in some communities. They may feel bad for your blue-collar worker in West Virginia who used to be a coal miner but now is black long and there's no jobs anyway. They may feel some guilt there, but what are they going to do to actually stand up and change that? They're not going to. So I don't think that we should worry so much about what their opinion is and if they are turned off to direct resistance and meaningful challenges to the status quo. What we should care about, yes, we should care about what the rank and file workers, the blue collar or white collar, do think about what we do. But generally speaking, they want to know that we're on their side. And if we could show that we're a friend, and not just a friend for a day at a big rally, but when you go home to your communities and when they're walking a picket line, if you're walking a picket line with them, then that's what they're going to remember and that's what they're going to care about and you're going to be on their side, which we did as a Green Mountain Anarchist Collective. I remember walking a UE, United Electrical Worker picket line in St. Johnsbury at the Fairbanks Scale Factory. They were on strike and we were preventing the union workers, but also the Green Mountain Anarchist Collective. We were seeking to block a member of management from UPS driving a truck into the factory. And that broke out into scuffles with the sheriff's department. And I exchanged headbutts, exchanged being the key word, you know, headbutts with a deputy sheriff. And when, then I took a face full of mace as a result. But when the sheriffs came to arrest me, the union president, Bob South, and four or five other guys stood in between me and the sheriffs and informed the sheriffs that nobody from the picket line was going to be arrested. And obviously there's an unfit threat there. I wasn't arrested, right? Next time we went to walk the picket line with him, Green Mountain Anarchist Collective, first of all, there was a massive police presence. The next time, state troopers and all that, bulletproof vests and, you know, snipers. But when we got there, nobody from that factory said, "What the hell are you doing?" We got a standing ovation. People clapped and were thrilled to see us because we showed that we're not just words, and we're not just there for a day, and we're not just showing up to Washington, D.C. or Seattle, breaking a window and going home, which, by the way, I'd say the vandalism part is, I don't know, it's probably different now, but back in the day, that was usually a West Coast thing, and the direct confrontation was usually an East Coast thing. But that's the day we made allies. I've been friends with Bob South for 20 years now. And again, with that union president, we don't always see eye to eye. In fact, he's a Democrat and successfully ran and served several terms in the state house as a state rep. But me and him have a bond, and we'll have a bond, agree or disagree about specific issues anytime. And that bond was formed on the picket line, and that bond was not formed through voluntarily getting arrested or doing something symbolic, which did nothing.
Right.
We won their strike, by the way.
You know, a lot of people, I think, right now would be thinking, okay, well, then how do we go from, you know, because you can watch the footage. If you watch, like, Breaking the Spell, you can see the union members, like, being like, yeah, the kids in black are the ones, you know, fighting for our future. So how do we go to that to then, you know, yeah, Donald Trump talking about globalism, he's fighting for our future. I mean, obviously, not everybody did that, but there was a sizable section of the population that did kind of swallow, you know, that red pill, so to speak. So how did that happen?
Well, I don't pretend to understand the insanity, which is the politics of the United States, but I do pretend, or I do believe I know, the politics of Vermont. And in Vermont, 29%, only 29% of our people voted for Donald Trump. And right now he's polling in the low 20s. So we weren't fooled in Vermont, but we also have a long and perhaps stronger social movement here than in many parts of the country. And our ties are very deep, so to speak, throughout labor, throughout environmental movement, et cetera. But how does that happen? Well, clearly we have to blame the National Democratic Party. A ham sandwich could have defeated Donald Trump in the election, but the Democratic Party, in all their wisdom, decided that the best thing to do would be to rig the system in every conceivable way to make the most hated woman in the United States of America be their candidate. And of course, the Clintons have been the huge proponents of free trade. Let's remember that NAFTA was started under the watch of Bill Clinton, and they have been huge enemies of prison reform, which is a key issue to black and Latino and poor white, I'd even say, communities across the United States. So you got a crazy man, a third-rate Mussolini, who's out of his fucking mind, saying, "I'll tear up the free trade agreements. Fuck free trade." And then you got a serial liar, Hillary Clinton, says, "Well, you know, I'll do good things and I won't do bad things." But we all know where she really stands as one of the key elite in the United States. And rightly so, people didn't believe Hillary Clinton. I didn't vote for Hillary Clinton. I didn't vote for Trump either. But it's easy enough to see why somebody would pick the insane alternative versus pick the alternative that we have already lived through for lifetimes now that hasn't worked. It's sad. It's difficult, and it's a problem that he won, and he won with 3 million less votes than the person he defeated. But you look about how many people didn't vote. I mean, how many? I don't know the number off the top of my head, but how many tens of millions chose not to vote at all? So that's just something in and of itself.
Right.
I mean, this is a person who won with minuscule amount of votes, less than his challenger, because he basically says, yeah, the system's corrupt, the system's all fucked up. A billionaire saying that, by the way, which is insane in and of itself. And I'm going to get rid of free trade. Of course, he didn't get rid of free trade. And of course, he brought nothing but billionaires into his administration. And clearly, as you can see with the tax cuts, he's doing nothing more than serving the billionaire class, which he came out of. But what was it, Goebbels, that said, you know, the bigger the lie, the more the people will believe it. So take it out of the fascist playbook.
Yeah, totally. I mean, the vast majority of people in the United States did not vote for either candidate. I've even heard, I think on this podcast, we've talked about how even in the swing states where there was, you know, a tight race, the biggest amount of people that voted, you know, for president voted for no one actually. And, you know, not Clinton or Trump. Yeah. I'm just curious if you can, I want to kind of go back to the Black Bloc. I had one more question. It was the Green Anarchist Collective that wrote the article that kind of called for, it was something like, you know, a return of the Derrida column or something like that.
A return to what? Oh, yes. I know what you're talking about. Yes.
Can you just describe that? Because that was a very, at the time and still today, I'm sure, very contentious article that ruffled a lot of feathers.
Sure. But also had a lot of support.
Okay.
So there's common sense, right? Here's the common sense. Our object is to win. And obviously, strategically, that's a long-term proposition. But tactically, in the here and now, in the immediacy of an action, it means a certain thing. And part of what winning means is not getting surrounded and having hundreds of people sent to jail and perhaps be faced with felony charges of various kinds. It's not a suicide mission. The moment that any tactic becomes a suicide mission is the moment where, you know, I'd question the sanity of those that are organizing it. The object is to win. So, personally speaking, I've been to a number of Black Blocs in the early days where we would argue, you know, hundreds of people would have a collective argument on at a crossroads of which way to go. And you'd be standing there for 5 minutes hollering and screaming and trying to figure out what we got to do and where we're going to go. That's insane. That's crazy. If you are a lightly equipped street fighting force and the entirety of your success or failure relies on your mobility, then you sure as hell have to be able to make a decision, stick to it, and move very quickly. So it's common sense. And so what we proposed is that the Bloc would elect essentially a tactical core that would make those key decisions at various times. What makes it different than the Army, say, right, is you have the right to leave anytime you want. You're not going to get in trouble if you decide, you know what, this isn't working out, I'm going to go the other way. So it'd be voluntary by nature. It'd be elected, like in Spain, like in Rova, like anywhere where there's ever been a real struggle that has a chance of success. You don't just all decide as individuals at the last minute to go right or left or to go forward or to charge or to not charge. You discuss before the action in hand the general goal of the action, the general what it would generally look like, what you want to see happen, and then to democratically empower a number of folks to facilitate that while you're in motion in a very quick way makes sense. And we call that anarchism when it's done in Rova in northern Syria. We call that anarchism when it's done in Spain and around Barcelona in 1936. We call that anarchism when it's done in the Ukraine during the Russian Civil War. Why don't we call that anarchism when we seek to do it ourselves in our country, in our struggle, in our time? So that's really the gist of it. I don't think it should be controversial, but of course, in the mix of what is generally lumped in as an anarchist movement in North America, United States and Canada, etc., to a certain extent Mexico, we have a lot of people that self-identify with the movement, who really are only marginally interested in the politics and in the leftism and in actually winning. And kind of the way that I may have viewed anarchism when I was 16 years old in high school, we'll see it more as just a rejection of all it is, without a desire to achieve what could be. And so we'll always hear criticisms from those type of folks, and I don't doubt it, and nor do I put much credence to it.
Okay, fair enough. Well, just kind of in closing, you know, the Black Bloc is still, you know, front page news. Obviously, nowadays it's associated strongly with anti-fascism. But I'm just curious, you know, looking at things unfold, what advice would you give to people that are entering the struggle now, based on all your experiences?
What advice? Well, we need to have goals. We can't jump from one crisis to another. It's a good and important and smart thing for actions, Antifa, Black Bloc actions, to shut down, battle, and confront fascists or enemies of working people, wherever they may be. But it will never equal victory unless we first define what victory is. And for me, for many people, and I would hope for what is the anarchist movement or the leftist movement, that victory is a society in which people have democratic control over their communities, their lives, their workplaces, and people's basic needs are met, which of course we have the ability to do. But we need to question, every time we decide to engage in a struggle, a movement, in action, we have to question how is this contributing to getting to that goal? How is this contributing to making a step closer to the realization of the world that we intend to leave to our children? And there are times when the answer might be, this really doesn't, but it has to be done. You know, when local fascists may be organizing, trying to organize in a community, maybe shutting them down isn't going to be a step closer to that goal, but it's still necessary. But still, more than half the time, if not 80% of the time, we need to put our energy towards these proactive projects that aren't a rejection of something, but rather an affirmation of something we hope to achieve. So either a social revolution comes about in a moment, or it's constructed over time, or it's a combination of the two. And if we are going to organize in a proactive building kind of way, then we are tacitly giving a nod to the possibility that this is something that will be constructed over time. And so what are we doing to achieve that? How are we making the union we are part of now more democratic and more militant? How are we articulating with the workers who are in the union with us the type of free democratic society and democratic union we want to be part of? How are we empowering the farmers to have more control over their production and their livelihoods, et cetera, as opposed to the milk processors or the big distributors? How are we actually building that democracy? If the answer is this project does not build that after a fair, open debate, then perhaps that's not the project we should be working on. Does spending 80% of your time for the next year and a half building an anarchist community center, a bookstore, does that actually get you closer to where you need to be? In some cases, maybe in our human community, it does. In a lot of cases, the answer is no, it isn't. Do we organize inside our own ghetto? Do we prioritize that, so to speak, in the anarchist ghetto? Or do we organize among the great thousands and millions of working people who don't have power in their lives? And what we need to do is we need to not be in our ghetto. We need to build a movement which involves the great majority of working people. Our only true advantage over the man is our numbers. And if we don't find a way to bring people into that movement, then we're never going to have an advantage over the man.
Right. Well, listen, Dave, thanks so much for joining us. We're coming up on an hour here. Can you just real quick tell people about the book that you have and how they can get a hold of it?
Great. Yes, thank you. It is called On Anarchism, Dispatches from the People's Republic of Vermont. It is a lot of my writing from 1999 through 2007. There are some essays in there that were crafted jointly with the Green Mountain Anarchist Collective, but this is the key writings that I'm proud to have been part of over that period of time. It is available direct to the publisher, and the publisher is Algora Publishing. I'd recommend, or I'd encourage people to take a look at it. Agree or disagree, I think it'll spark some thought and some discussion, and I look forward to being part of that discussion.
Awesome, yeah, and in the podcast notes, we'll link to a way that you can buy the book. But hey, thanks so much for joining us. Anything else you want to say?
No, it's been a pleasure. Appreciate talking to you today.
Corrupt up in this motherfucker. West Side. Ever since a nigga was a seed, only thing promised to me was the penitentiary. Still ballin', riding on these niggas cause they lame. In a 6-1 Chevy, still heavy in this game. Can you feel me? Blame it on my mama, I'm a thug nigga. Before the sun rise, quicker than the drug dealer.